Good morning, all. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 12th of November. Very nice. Very nice to have you all in the studio here and at home or wherever you may be listening to the program. And we thank you very much for taking time out of your day to make us part of your day. We have a lot to talk about. We have a great group to do it with, and we'll get started momentarily. A reminder, if you'd like to get in, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. There's a lot to talk about. Please keep your letters short and to the point, and we'll attempt to get to as many as we possibly can. Let me introduce our group as it stands at the moment, and then we'll get started. We welcome Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Jim Handler is here. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Joe. Starting slowly to get over the depression.
All right, we'll get you on.
Let's try that.
Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead.
I'm doing okay, Joe. slowly getting over the shock and depression and moving on.
Well, good morning, and very nice to have you with us. We welcome J.P. Miller. J.P., it seems like it's been a long time since I've seen you. I don't know if that's true or not. Yeah, so we've missed you.
I missed you, and one of my slots was during the fund drive, which I tuned into, and you all did such a great job, and that, I think, is the reason for it. It's not that I'm...
No, not that you've distanced yourself from the program or that your agent had incredible demands or something. No, this is all just the way the cookie crumbles.
They did double his salary here.
Yes, from zero to zero is a pretty good sum. We love having you here, as always. It's very nice to welcome you back to the program.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
We also will welcome Mike Spain, former Times Union associate editor. And Mike comes from this very far-off foreign land called Schenectady.
Wow.
And sometimes when he comes through it, when the thruway is backed up, he gets in that snarl. So he is right now, his ETA is 9:26 according to his GPS. So we'll see how accurate that is. But we wish him well on his way in, and we'll welcome him with open arms when he comes to our studio. But in the meantime, you two get to just chat it up about all of these stories that we will talk about today. So, hey, look, there's a lot of different stuff. Many of the stories that we'll talk about today have to do with announcements that were made to the Trump cabinet. And yesterday, there were a lot of them, many of them. And they were coming out fast and furious. And I would say within a rather short period of time, I think we learned about six major choices that would be named to the cabinet. So I'm just going to go down those real quick, and I'm probably going to forget some, but we'll give it a shot anyway. Marco Rubio was named late last night, or is expected to be named. That is according to a Washington Post and CNN report, that Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who has taken hardline positions on China, Iran, and Venezuela, will be the Secretary of State. Then, of course, yesterday brought the announcement of Stephen Miller and Thomas Homan as working on the immigration crackdown. Excuse me. Michael Waltz is said to be the choice for national security advisor. We learned that yesterday as well. Lee Zeldin has been named as the choice for the Environmental Protection Agency. And Kristi Noem, the South Dakota governor, probably best known to American audiences for writing in her book, bragging that she shot a 14-month-old puppy because he wasn't training fast enough. She has been named as the head of the Department of Homeland Security. So there are many others, but those are some of the headlines that we look at this morning. And So we'll talk about some of those, and then we'll also talk about who's going to replace Mitch McConnell as Senate GOP leader. And John Thune had been in that mix, and has been in that mix for a long time, and now allies to Trump are pushing back and are not looking forward to having John Thune as the Senate Majority Leader. So a lot to kind of unpack and to figure out. I guess I would like to begin with Stephen Miller. The Trump transition focuses on deportations as Miller assumes influence. And Stephen Miller has long been a part of the Trump orbit. He was there from the very beginning, and he continues to be. He is expected to name the immigration hardliner as deputy chief of staff, also announced a former ICE official as his border czar. Those two announcements coming yesterday. Stephen Miller is an advisor to President Trump, is taking over policy planning for the transition, and is expected to be named deputy chief of staff in his administration, according to people briefed on the matter yesterday. Late Sunday, Mr. Trump announced on social media that Thomas Homan, the acting director of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency during Mr. Trump's first term, would be his border czar. It remains to be seen how broad Mr. Miller's portfolio will be, but it is expected to be vast and to far exceed what the eventual title will convey, according to people briefed on the matter. Try to work through that sentence a couple times and see exactly what you get out of it. A Trump spokesman did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Mr. Miller also did not respond to a message seeking comment. Mr. Miller's views are favored by Mr. Trump's hardline base, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance and Donald Trump Jr., who has been influential in the transition, praised the prospective choice on X, the social media platform formerly known as Twitter. The expected move was reported first by CNN. Mr. Trump has talked repeatedly since 2023 about his plans for the largest deportation effort in the country's history. Among the only potential restraints on those efforts might be negative media coverage, such as the kind he faced when his first administration enacted the policy of separating children from their parents during unauthorized border crossings. Mr. Homan was an ardent supporter of that policy. Mr. Miller is expected to work closely with Mr. Homan to oversee the planned deportations as well as the nation's maritime and aviation security. In an interview with 60 Minutes that aired on CBS in October, Mr. Homan described targeted arrests and workplace enforcements when asked about the deportation plan. So here's when you get into the shades of gray, although not really. It's not okay to enter a country illegally, which is a crime, he said. That's what drives illegal immigration, and there's no consequences. So in this mass deportation policy, those who are surrogates to the campaign and surrogates to the transition are saying that this is that we believe that pretty much everyone can agree that if you're in this country and you are a criminal, you should be deported. And I think essentially that is true, depending on what the definition of criminal is. But let's say it is serious crimes. The question becomes then, what's next? What's the next step there to take it to the next level? And those details are less forthcoming. And so we look at this information and think, okay, so what does this mean? Mr. Miller has been working on mass deportation plans over the past 2 years. He outlined these and other hardline immigration policies in an interview with the New York Times last year. The plans include restricting legal and illegal immigration in a number of ways, including rounding up undocumented immigrants already in the United States and detaining them in camps before they're expelled from the country. A handful of other people from the top of Mr. Trump's campaign ranks are expected to be among the deputy chiefs of staff announced as soon as this week. Jim.
Oh, gosh, where to even start? You know, Trump ran on immigration again this year. He did last time, 8 years ago. You know, he was going to build a border wall. Mexico was going to pay for it. We all know how that worked out. We do indeed have a border wall in a whole lot of little pieces. Mexico didn't pay a penny, and it didn't stop immigration, nor would it. Had they even completed it, which had been already deemed virtually impossible just from a land use, land ownership, et cetera, point of view. You have, you know, the bastion of this stuff is not just the negative publicity, but it's also the courts, which now, with a Republican Senate and Trump able to nominate pretty much whoever he wants, and the Heritage Foundation giving him the lists of potential judges, which is what he did last time, and they announced it again this time. You know, we know that it'll be a judiciary that includes new people who will support some of these more aggressive actions. We also know that the Supreme Court has given him far more power than previous presidents in terms of some of this. But I think the interesting thing to me, with interesting sort of in air quotes, because I don't know how to play out, is many of the people he's appointing now don't know anything about the thing they're being appointed to. And, you know, the example I always come up with when I think about this is 8 years ago, he appointed Rick Perry to be the head of the Department of Energy, largely because Rick Perry was a climate denier, was considered to be, you know, had literally run on the platform of getting rid of the Department of Energy. And then I can only report this anecdotally from friends, because if I had learned it in a secure environment, I couldn't talk about it. But they ended up thinking Perry was at, well, I can say clearly that a lot of the people who were very worried about him ended up thinking he was a pretty good Secretary of Energy. The reason is, they said, when he got there and discovered what it is the Department of Energy actually does, he discovered you do need a Department of Energy. The Department of Energy maintains the U.S. nuclear force, does all the investment into nuclear security, on and on, as well as many other things we can't even talk about. So, you know, he suddenly realized he was in charge of something really important. I think DHS, you know, we saw this last time Trump was charged. He put in people who are going to focus solely on immigration. Cybersecurity went to heck. You know, my friends who are now working in CISO, the cybersecurity office that was created, are already hearing they're going to see cutbacks. And, you know, if I was going to say which is the greater threat to our country, immigration or cybersecurity, I'd have a whole lot of trouble making the case for immigration. So I really worry that, you know, some of these people are coming in. I hope some of them will learn the importance of what they're doing. I hope the new UN ambassador will understand that foreign relations actually matters and that, but, you know, we'll just have to see. But, you know, one of the things people said over and over again is believe what he says. And there were a lot of people saying, oh, he'll never do the things he said. Well, he's appointing the people who are exactly on the list of people he said he would appoint, and he's appointing them to exactly the things he said. And we're going to see an exceedingly cruel immigration policy, at least for a while. And we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Stephen Miller, when he spoke, of course, Stephen Miller perhaps best known and first came on the scene of writing the American Carnage speech that was the inaugural speech that Trump gave in 2017. But when he spoke, which I believe was the last time he spoke in public at the Madison Square Garden event, he said that only Trump would allow Americans to live in a country where criminal gangs cannot just cross our border and rape and murder with impunity, he told the crowd. It happens every single day, regardless that there is no proof of that. He also, echoing a line, Germans for Germans only, said during that rally, America is for Americans and Americans only. And that is another thing. I mentioned this at the time that I was, I know a lot of people were making a big deal about the comedian, and I thought to myself, it seems to me that the more concerning thing here is what the guy who may actually get a job of what he is saying from the dais at Madison Square Garden. JP.
Yes, Stephen Miller is, as you stated, Joe, a longtime aide to Trump. And when I say aide, that's kind of understating it. He, as you mentioned, is a speechwriter. He understands and articulates and helps form the MAGA agenda and has done that ever since the beginning of Trump's run. Him being appointed to Deputy Secretary of State, I'm not surprised at. I almost thought that was a position too low for someone like Stephen Miller, because I think of him truly as one of a very small group of core Trump people who are you know, his advisors. On the immigration stuff, Texas Governor Abbott really turned this into a national issue. And even Josh Riley, who's the recently elected Democrat in the Hudson Valley, who was running against Mark Molinaro, I watched Josh Riley's television ads on TV, and they seemed like Trump ads. I'm going to be tough on the border. I'm going to cut down on the gangs and the fentanyl and all that stuff. And so even Democrats that are running on an anti-immigrant agenda, and seeing that Trump is going to focus on this in his early days, it's clearly something he's going to do. They felt like they ran on this, and they should execute because of the results of the election.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, Mike Spain is here. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Thank you very much. We'll get to Mike on his thoughts on all of this and continue our conversation. We always welcome you into the chat as well. Panel at WAMC.org. First, this news from the BBC.
And if I'm lucky, maybe a hand next to mine. Oh, if
playing the music of Haley Hendricks this morning, and Haley playing The Egg tomorrow, November 13th. TheEgg.org, TheEgg.org. You can see the playlist posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. All right, Mike Spain joins us, and Mike, I can repose the question, but considering I think you were in the car listening to it, I will just reiterate. Yes.
Yeah. Putting in Stephen Miller, I agree with you, JP. I think that he, Trump is demonstrating, I am serious about what I said. I am he has the plan. He's articulated it for a while. As you mentioned, Joe, he was quite extensive in detail, even 18 months ago, Stephen Miller was, in saying how we could carry about a mass deportation of immigrants. And, the rhetoric is there, the public sentiment is there. And, Jim, in spite of the fact that, cybersecurity is probably a much bigger threat on our existence than the number of immigrants that have come into the country, it's not that way. Right. The public doesn't see it that
exactly.
way. Yeah, the public doesn't see it that way. And therefore, Trump wants to demonstrate what he believes he has a mandate and arguably has somewhat of a mandate to carry out. And that is solve the immigration problem. I don't think it's going to go very smoothly. This reminds me of the interviews that a lot of TV did about 6 months after the UK voted to leave the European Union,
right.
Brexit.
Yes.
They went around interviewing people, and they sort of pointed out, you can't buy that cheese anymore from France because it takes so long to get here, it will spoil. Or you can't buy this because it's going to be very expensive and it's going to be delayed. And you can't do this. And you're going to lose that. And that bank is going to move over to Dublin or over to Brussels. And all those people are going to be without work. You know, and people were going, oh, I didn't realize that was part of Brexit. Oh, if I had known that, you know, but it'll be too late. And it was too late. And now, you know, 8 years later, the UK is still suffering and trying to rebuild back from it. I think there's going to be a lot of remorse with some of the policies that come along. When Elon Musk is trying to cut $2 trillion out of the budget so that, you know, he can meet some fiscal goal that Trump sort of promised. The money won't be coming in. It's going to mean cuts to programs, social programs, discretionary spending for, you know, things. They're looking at cutting back the CHIP Act. They're looking at cutting back Obamacare. You know, so it's just a process that has to go on now that people are going to see what they bought. You know, they now they get to see what they bought, and it might not be that popular, and it might be not the smooth sailing that people thought we'd have after the election was finally ended.
I know this is not what you were implying, but oh, if it was only about cheese.
Yes, I know. If only it were about cheese. Now, having said all that, obviously, you know, and this is like a summary of a million analyses that I've read and listened to in the last few days. The Democrats, Kamala Harris and the Democrats, didn't offer a vision that people embraced. And, you know, that's another whole yarn. But people definitely turned away from her, maybe didn't vote. And we'll talk about that, I guess, a little bit
well,
later.
Well, a vision that didn't resonate or just didn't have a vision.
Right. If we want to go in this direction, I think that, yes, it was unclear just exactly what it was. I think reminds me of that ABBA song, Take a Chance on Me.
Yeah.
You don't really know what she was going to bring. Trump made it very clear what he wanted to bring.
Well, Trump had that moment in the first campaign where he was like, what do you got to lose? Give it a shot.
Right now.
See what happens.
He still won.
Right.
Well, that was a different set of dynamics in 2016. I mean, we could talk and talk and talk about all the reasons that the election went this way. But I think, generally speaking, you're right, Joe. The Democrats were not able to present a clear vision of what they were offering. They were just saying, Trump's really bad. Pick me because I'll try to make things better, even though I know you're unhappy right now.
Well, you know, I think that I think you're tapping into something, and I've noticed it too. When you listen to many of the shows, of course, it's all anecdotal because they're talking to a few voters from where, but the Trump voters are generally saying things used to be better. I want us to go back to how it was. It's unclear to me what was better and when it was.
What are we talking about? The 1950s, the 1990s, the late teens,
2000? I mean, we can pick whatever you want.
The 30s.
But you had people who said things are not as good as they used to be, and you had a campaign with a slogan which is, we're not going back. And I think it was that mismatch.
But it didn't say where we're going. That's
No. I know. I'm saying. But so in other words, it said, you know, things were bad and we're not going back there. And people were saying, well, things are worse now, so we do want to go
back there.
And I think the messaging, I mean, I agree with you completely. If you actually read the policies, which
nobody
easily
does.
Six or seven Democrats did, there were lots of very specific proposals in there. And the problem was they were not easy, visible, quick things. So I think that's part of it. I mean, yes, the Democrats, you know, we've said every show so far that I've heard that we're going to have to, you know, they're going to have to really think hard. But I think on Friday's show, Aaron said something that really struck me as what's going to be the equivalent of cheese. which is how much the American economy relies on immigration. And the people in the border states who felt overwhelmed, you know, started shipping people up. They started feeling overwhelmed. But what they've missed is that once those people become legal, get work permits, find ways to work, those people pay taxes, those people do necessary jobs. You know, they're not coming to take your job if you're employed. And if you're unemployed, when there's 5 million jobs open, why are you unemployed? Because you don't want to take those jobs. And so I think we're really going to see a shift in not so much people's opinion of immigration, but people's opinion of work. They're going to start realizing that some of these jobs have to happen.
I don't think you're ever going to see people all of a sudden say, "Okay, having an open border is a good policy." Immigration has been the gift that keeps on giving for the Republicans. But the analysis of the election, really, my view is very simple: is that she barely lost in the swing states, okay? She lost by 1 and 2 percentage points.
Yes.
When you lose by 2 percentage points, that means you only needed 1 out of 100 voters to flip to win that election. The swing states is where it's played. She is running on the back of an incumbent president with a 37% approval rating, okay? Mm-hmm. No matter how good of a candidate she is or could have been, running on the back of an incumbent with a 37% approval rating. That's extremely hard to do. She had 9 weeks to do it.
Yep.
They asked her a number of times, how are you different than Joe Biden? She never had a good answer for that. And in that case, you know, I think there's a lot of hand-wringing amongst the Democrats of saying, oh, we shouldn't have been for this policy or that policy. It's really, in my view, more of the political climate
was
against the incumbent Biden. The Republican got in now in 2 years, okay, which is, us old guys, we blink a couple times and 2 years is going to come. Donald Trump, my view, is going to likely come into the midterms with a 37% approval rating. And there is going to be, in the first midterm of a presidency, there is going to be likely a blue wave of 10 to 30 seats in 2 years, and so it's going to cycle back to the Democrats.
We know that from history. I mean,
yes,
it just it comes back and back. I mean, we see this replay itself all the time.
Yes.
I want to take a quick break. I just one of the other things I would like to talk about when we come back, and we have a lot of letters too, so I want to get to those. But the other thing is this House majority, and this is getting even more difficult because President Trump's picking a lot of people from the House to go into these positions.
Exactly.
So that also is an issue, as evidenced by Lee Zeldin and Elise Stefanik and others. So we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll get some of your letters and, there's so much more. We'll get to all of it right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 12th of November. I'm Joe Donahue, along with Jim Henler, J.P. Miller, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I mentioned we have a lot of letters. I'd like to get to some of those this morning. Before we go to the top of the hour break, James writes to us and says, when you examine each of the people that Trump is appointing, one thing becomes painfully clear. They each believe in and support the lie about the 2020 election having been stolen. They're liars. Instead of serving the American people, they swear allegiance to Trump. Loyalty to him outranks even the Constitution itself. It's now official. We are becoming a fascist dictatorship that's only disguised as a democracy. And not to pick apart the letter, really, but even if you take 2020 out of it, or I'm sorry, January 6th out of it, I mean, we've known
election
this.
Denial about out of it.
Well, we know this about Trump even before January 6th, which is it's that undying loyalty that he's looking for. It's always been the undying loyalty that he's been looking for.
What I would say is, looking at him putting together his cabinet now, we have one to compare it to, which is back after he won in 2016. He was not expecting to win And there were a lot of people, establishment Republicans, coming in saying, oh, wow, there's a Republican in the White House. We can be part of it, like Rex Tillerson and Reince Priebus and Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs. And in the early days of that first Trump White House, I think there was a big tug of war between establishment institutionalist Republicans and people that thought, oh, maybe now that he's been elected, maybe he'll act like just a normal guy. Maybe that was all a shtick. Remember, that's something I think a lot of people thought.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think we thought he'd sort of, you know, we might not like his policies, but, you know, he's picking people who will kind of keep the rails on. You know?
Right. There was some.
Ben Carson's a doctor. He'll be fine.
Yes. There were people that were like, oh, we'll put the guardrails on him. And now the folks know, you know, all of these people that have been appointed by him, I would say, are really implementers. They will take their orders from Stephen Miller. They will take their orders from the White House Chief of Staff and implement what the president wants. It will not be advice and vigorous debate about issues. It will not be that. These are all folks that will be 100% subservient to Trump. Whatever he does, they will back him up. They will go on TV and back up his message. And you can see it one after the next. All of his appointments, he made it very clear on Truth Social, I think, over the weekend. Nikki Haley will not be a part of his administration. Right. Yeah. And the other former Pompeo will also not be. So this will very, very much be a MAGA White House.
Although
to the core.
Absolutely. And I don't disagree with you. Thursday and Friday, it was announced that Kristi Noem would not be.
Oh, really?
Would not be a part of the administration, and that she had been removed from the list. And then yesterday was announced that she would be the head of the Department of Homeland Security.
Let's admit, though, that any elected president begins to reward those who supported him. I mean, that happens every time we have a change in the White House, that, you know, to the winner goes the spoils. And certainly that's going on. What I think is an interesting anecdote that I read yesterday is the process that they're going through in Mar-a-Lago. It's been reported. I think it was in the Washington Post and the New York Times, that they're sitting in like a war room that they've set up down in Mar-a-Lago, which makes sense, you know, like a strategy room. And they have a bunch of TVs on, and there's like these video resumes of the candidates for these various positions, including how those people came across when they were interviewed on TV, how well they defended Trump, how articulate they were in speaking about his plans and his policy. And I think that is an astute recognition that they need to continue the selling of these ideas, the ideas that maybe people didn't completely understand when they chose to vote for Trump. It was more on head and emotion and gut. You know, it wasn't it was on emotion and gut rather than on a thoughtful consideration of the implications of those policies that the candidate was saying. And because of that, they know that they need not only to get loyalists in these jobs, but loyalists who are telegenic and can come across on blogs and on social media and on the favorable TV stations. Apparently, the CEO of Newsmax was at Mar-a-Lago yesterday, which is the up-and-coming alternative to Fox that Trump has been promoting since 2020. And, you know, it's going to be a big part of him reaching his audience. Yep.
You know, I think what you will see, and, you know, obviously it'll be after inauguration, will be churn. You know, the one thing you can predict is that Trump will be either firing people or making some transactional deals. And, you know, that's really been the word for Trump, is transactional. I mean, you know, so, for example, I look at him putting Lee Zeldin into EPA. Zeldin's running primarily on an anti-electric vehicle platform. Trump's biggest funder was Elon Musk. I can't see how those two are not going to come head to head at some point, nor do I see how Trump backs a, backs the one who doesn't have all the money and helped get him into the White House. The other one, and you can see some other things like that happening down the road. I think it'll be very interesting to see how some of these things play out. He suddenly, we're going to be the crypto capital of the world after having been for years anti-crypto, actually for good reasons. Why? Because of where the money came from. And so I think we're going to see some of these things where stuff he, first of all, some of the things he doesn't control, because the president doesn't control everything. Second of all, some of the people he puts in who do discover what their job really is and want to do it. And third, just simply the incoherence of the fact that this person supported him for this reason, this person for that reason, this person for the next reason, and now there's no way to make all of them happy. So it's going to depend who can please him the most. I was going to use a different expression, but we'll go with please him.
Yes. When you look at the list, and it is interesting to look at the list, but of how long people lasted in the first administration, Robert Snyder, when the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, came in on January 20th. He left on February 14th of the same year. Robert Wilkie started on March 28th. He left on May 29th. Peter O'Rourke started on May 29th. He left on July 30th of 2018. My personal favorite, no, that's not my favorite. Where's my favorite? My favorite is Moreau Park, who started on January 20th and left on January 23rd as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. So
these are not household names.
48 hours?
Yeah.
48
so,
hours?
So I'm no, just, 72.
That makes
I'm just saying
Scaramucci
that I,
look like a long-term.
And I think a lot of this, obviously that's indicated by probably trouble getting confirmation, trouble coming in. But even as you look down the line of people who were moved from one position to the other and then eventually were worked out of the system, it's quite a list.
But I don't think that you're going to see that this time. I think you might see some problems with confirmations, but they have he's already urging the Senate and the Senate leadership, whatever that may be after today, or after this week when they pick a new Senate majority leader, the Republicans do. He's urging the quick approval, recess approvals, which
yes.
will let people take office. Because the approvals, because of the calendars, because of glitches, because of fights from Democrats, you name it, approvals may take up to a year or more. And he wants to get these people on the scene so he can do recess appointments and they can take their jobs, they can be the acting, whatever it is he appointed them to, and they can start doing it. And, if 6 months, 12 months down the road, they don't get Senate approval, it's the job was done. He achieved what he wanted to achieve.
Well, yeah, I think that's right. And, he sent a note that essentially is asking the Senate to recess for 2 years. Ideally, he could do it just for the transition period, although it's unclear how that would happen since the Senate doesn't change over quite yet.
Right.
But he literally wrote that he'd like to see them essentially say—
Hands off.
The Senate's not going to do anything for 2 years. If he wins the House, all the Senate would—that would be interesting because then the Senate can't be in recess when the House proposes something that has to become a law. So some of the things he wants, but we'll see. But, the other thing is some of the people he's put into place, it's hard to believe, not in terms of their loyalty or things like that, but, for example— most people haven't heard of Robert Wilkie. Robert Wilkie was his head of the VA. Wilkie, after mishandling some sexual harassment cases, every single VA supporting entity was against him. He was reviled. They said this guy should not be running the VA. He lost many veterans' votes over this. He's now put that person in charge of the transition team for the Pentagon.
Oh, that should work.
Yeah, and I'm saying, so it's like almost hard to understand some of these things.
I think
sometimes you think he's setting some of these guys up to fail just so he has a few people to fire.
No, I think there's hubris here. I think there's an absolute belief that he's not going to repeat the errors of 2016 and 17 when he took office. And he's going to get his people in there. They're going to be loyal. And they're going to complete the promises that he made during his campaign. Take him for his word.
Charlie writes to us and says, what was better in 50s and 60s? Since about 1970, the financial situation of the working class has deteriorated. Wages have not kept up with inflation, and little has been done to reverse deindustrialization. That from Charlie. We go to this letter from Diane. How will Elise Stefanik explain to the dairy farmers, a major industry in her district, when the immigration people come to get those workers?
She won't have to. She'll be down at the UN.
Also, Michael says we need a report card for Trump on a billboard in Times Square or front page of the New York Times listing all the things he promised and does not deliver. I would say most papers probably do this for every president
routinely, in some way. Not on the front page every day.
Maybe not in Times Square, but close to it. Closing the border, a million deportations, end of the Ukraine war, ending Gaza conflict, bring grocery prices down, et cetera, et cetera. He will not be able to accomplish any of his agenda, and we need to publicize his failures. A daily report card, public, visible, every day. Donnie's report card. And finally, before we go to the break, we end with this letter. Trump is anti-immigrant. Trump naturalized 2 million mostly black and brown legal immigrants during his first term. Obama did the same thing in each of his two terms. If we need more than that, great. Let's do it legally. That from Charles. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, move on to other topics, and welcome you to the equation. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Ray Graff is next. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you here, and we thank you very much for being with us and being a part of the program. We're going to move on to other topics. We'll get back to some more letters in a moment, although we have gotten to most of the big ones as far as most of the views expressed have been expressed, so we'll move on. I want to go to some of the other stories because, as I said from the very beginning, a lot of this has to do with these appointments, and we've been talking about Stephen Miller, and we've been talking about many that have to do with the border and our security. I would like to talk about Lee Zeldin in the EPA, a New York congressman who has been elevated. All of these, of course, are pending approval. So this is just the picks, whether they actually come to be or not. We shall see. Trump chooses Lee Zeldin to run the EPA as he plans to gut climate rules. We were talking briefly before about the electric cars and the issues here that are important to the incoming Trump administration. But President-elect Donald Trump announced on Monday that he would nominate former Representative Lee Zeldin, Republican of New York, to lead the Environmental Protection Agency, a position that is expected to be central to Mr. Trump's plans to dismantle landmark climate regulations. Mr. Trump campaigned on pledges to, quote, kill and to, quote, cancel EPA rules and regulations to combat global warming by restricting fossil fuel pollution from vehicle tailpipes, power plant smokestacks, and oil and gas wells. Summed up by one administration officials, he said he wanted to drill, baby, drill, and this is the guy to help him do that. In particular, Mr. Trump wants to erase the Biden administration's most significant climate rule, which is designed to speed a transition away from gas-powered cars and toward electric vehicles. A former congressman from Long Island who ran unsuccessfully for governor in 2022, Mr. Zeldin, is an avid Trump supporter who voted against certifying the election results in 2020. It's an honor to join President Trump's cabinet as EPA administrator, Mr. Zeldin wrote on X. We will restore U.S. energy dominance, revitalize our auto industry to bring American jobs and make the U.S. the global leader of AI. We will do so while protecting access to clean air and water. Jim, as we're talking about the EPA of making the U.S. the global leader of AI, just remind us of why that's an environmental story.
So the AI industry is using huge amounts of power. You know, the simplest way to illustrate this is Microsoft has bought Three Mile Island and is restoring it so that they will, and it will be basically powering their AI efforts. The argument they make is this is how we will reduce emissions and we're being good guys. But in reality, what it is a way of getting a huge amount of power for themselves. And I don't mean power in the
electrical
political sense.
Power.
I mean electrical power.
But it could also currently, work the other way.
Currently, the chips that power AI are extremely powerful and energy
reliant. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they need a lot of energy. However, there's also a new effort underway to develop cheaper, better, faster ones. That are specialized because if you ever want it in your cell phone, in your car, et cetera, you can't have something that takes a nuclear plant to run.
Hopefully not.
It's really the training. It's really the creating the new things. And that's another interesting story that wasn't on our list today. I was just saw it this morning when I looked out, and I haven't had a chance to really trace it down yet. But apparently the AI companies are now running into the trouble that the systems aren't learning as fast as they used to. You can see a lot of reasons why, but what that means is they need even more training, even more data, even more power. So, you know, that's why Zeldin is able to throw AI in there, because what he's saying is we're going to put enough power into the system, enough electricity, that even the AI companies will be able to afford it.
Yeah, I thought that Lee Zeldin was a little bit of a weird pick for EPA. I never thought of him as someone who focused on the environment, but I do think that with the Trump administration, they are focused on inflation and the cost of goods, and the best way to tackle inflation is to bring down the cost of gasoline and the cost of energy. If you could reduce the cost of gasoline or the cost of oil by 25 or 50%, it would have a huge impact on every single product and good. It would have a huge impact on our economy. Lee Zeldin here for us in New York, of course, is most famous for coming within 6 points of beating our current governor, Kathy Hochul. The ramifications for us here in the state are people had expected that he might run for governor again in 2026. That seems like it will not happen. The other person that is likely to run for governor on the Republican side is Congressman Mike Lawler. And so people were expecting a potential Lawler-Zeldin primary on the Republican side, but it now looks like Lawler's biggest competition is now going to be in the Trump administration. But I thought, for whatever reason, when I saw Lee Zeldin and EPA, it didn't quite add up to me. Yeah. He doesn't seem to be, I've never heard of him talk about the environment or...
Oh, he ran very heavily on fracking. On fracking.
Yeah. I mean, he was pro-fracking during the gubernatorial race. But his performance, as you pointed out, within 5 points. I mean, it was close to 5 points, him falling behind Kathy Hochul. I think Trump admired that. He was a pit bull. Zeldin was a pit bull during that campaign. He saw an issue, which in that campaign was crime,
right.
And he played that one way, way big. And it felt like, you know, they were coming to your neighborhood to tear you out of your house and kill you the way that his campaign went. And I think it was very effective. It scared people. And I think Trump likes that. I think he likes somebody who can be a pit bull, who can push a policy through. It's almost irrelevant that it's the EPA. If it was crime, if it was, electric power, if it was environmental rules, if it was something else he put him in charge of, he'd be a pit bull for Trump wherever Trump would appoint him. And I think that's really what is going on here. He can be very effective in getting a message across and hammering. He did that and almost beat Kathy Hochul.
Let's go back to the letters. John writes, I have come to terms with the fact that President Trump and his supporters are happy. Why should I not be happy for half the country? My fellow American neighbors who voted for Trump believe that he will keep America safe by riding us off the villainy that is whatever Trump says at the time. Judging my fellow Americans has done nothing for me but to think the sky is falling. The two-party system gives America the illusion of choice. America has endured more telling times than the one we are all in now. I respect President Trump, but don't buy any of his reality TV-based politics. For 2 years, we hold our breath and see what each new day brings. So I'm cautiously empathetic for my fellow Americans who voted President Trump to the White House. I think that's an important letter because you're starting to hear more people say things, and this is extremely anecdotally, but when you talk to them about the election, don't get me wrong, I have a lot of friends who are ready to like jump out windows, but you do hear this perspective a lot.
Yeah, I think it's important to respect what happened and try to understand what happened. And I think it is, you know, we can't predict how it's going to play out. We're speculating ourselves based on, you know, what we've seen in the past. But it is really, it's going to be important for people to listen where they had not been listening.
I've heard that a lot. I think to some degree it's true. But you know what? I've heard lots of people on this station, and I've often been sitting next to them, say, we have to learn to talk to them. We have to learn to, you know, every time I've tried, I've been told that what an idiot I am. Every time I've tried, I've been told I'm wrong. How do I start meaningful and useful conversations with people who refuse to talk to me?
There's been a lot written about that. And most of it is you don't really talk, you listen. And that's about it.
But,
and maybe when people can air their feelings, and it is a lot about feelings. It's not just about facts. It's about feelings.
And where do they
bridge
a
little bit
there?
Where
do I go?
And I will see people on the other side will say the exact same thing.
Yes.
Yeah. When I try to talk to somebody on the other side, they tell me I'm stupid.
It's talking. On. That's the problem, Jim. You have to listen.
Well, I would say also is being on a side, I try and not be on a side these days, and being on a side naturally leads you to being combative with the other side. And what I would say to both sides is try to see where your own side is not making common sense. I think common sense is a big part of politics, and whatever side seems like they're the common sense party can hope to win over moderates. You're never going to win over the other side. You're looking to win over the people that voted for Joe Biden and then also voted for Trump, or the people that voted for Barack Obama and then voted for Trump. There are people that swing each election, and that's it.
It's hard.
You're gonna say common sense. You know, Trump doesn't exactly embody common sense.
No,
how
I'm not. I won't say that because I don't think any of politics embodies common sense. I mean, I wouldn't put that on just Trump and Republicans. I don't think any of it embodies common sense. I think if you look at the last 6 months of what the Democrats did, try to figure out the common sense there. I agree with you. I agree with what you're saying. I think, but it's also. I do think there is some of us who may be, and I don't know, no one in this room, of course, but maybe a little cynical and look and say, oh, I've seen this movie before. I know what's going to happen. And not that you're planning for the next insurrection, but you're going to, like, I mean, I did it earlier. I mean, here are the people, like, what is the percentage of people who are going to be named are going to be in that job in 6 months? And is that being cynical, or is that looking at the facts and research and saying we perhaps can extrapolate this from the history that we lived 8 years
ago? Well, and Trump, you know, started one of the earliest things. He one of his earliest critiques of Biden during the disastrous debate was he hasn't fired anyone. Right.
Yeah.
But I do want to I do want to reply to that listening thing, Mike, because the problem is the conversation is no longer happening in public. The conversation of people one-to-one isn't going to change things. But, for example, I have studied what's being published on Newsmax. I have gone on to some of the parts of the web where, I mean, it literally makes me sick. I have a former student who, for the past year, has called herself sort of the underground MAGA person. She's gone to MAGA rallies. She's listened to them closely. She's been writing an amazing blog on, you know, what she sees and what she hears. And, you know, it's pretty clear that we're living in a country where, you know, there really is a red America and a blue America, and there's very little in the middle. And that separation causes even more separation. I really, you know, have tremendous sympathy for those people who say what we really need is a third party that's in the middle. The problem is, I don't see how you get there. But it really, really is the case that people are not listening on either side. And you can't just go in and say, hey, I'm happy to listen. I mean, that doesn't work real well.
I think, though, that we need to take it to I understand what you're saying, Jim. I respectfully disagree with the idea of talking and working through problems. And I guess I'm looking at it at a very base level. In small towns and in small cities and in environments where these should not be overtly political issues. Are we going to buy the new school bus? Are we going to, who's going to be on the library board? Who's going to be in this position to talk about the curriculum for the school? And I think this is where we have to get, and perhaps, I would hope to think that we can move away from the politics of the national politics and talk about what's the best for our communities. And if that's something that we can work on, and it's something that we can educate people about, I think that is a really good starting place for a lot of us to have these conversations. I'm not saying that we have to sit down with people and change their minds on abortion. It's not going to happen. But if you can talk to people about, okay, this is why we don't feel we can buy a new fire truck this year, or this is why we feel we need to support our food pantry in town. Those are issues that I don't think are not overtly political and are issues that we can have as a community.
And these are why we should not ban the following book that you want to ban, because it's anti-Holocaust. And we don't want to ban this book because it says something nice about black people in America. You know, I know
no,
I'm
hear,
sounding
I
more
you.
Like Libby than like myself.
No,
but,
no, but you're
frankly,
right.
Joe is right. We need to start at the local level. But that national politic thing has hit the local level. And unless we can find new ways to change that conversation, when people are living in bubbles, it's just going to get worse.
But, you know, you sound like an elitist. I mean, with all due respect, we all sound like elitists because we are burdened by our knowledge because we've prepped for this. We're political junkies. We've read the facts. You know too many facts to be able to listen to somebody without saying, but that is wrong, you know, because of this, and this. This is the problem. If we keep throwing facts in people's faces while they're telling us how it is, we're never going to hear, we're never going to get down to the core of what's going on and then understand what it is and then learn what you need to say to people to make them understand. I mean, it sounds simple.
I also want to make clear that these are not always easy issues. I live in a community where I watched for, I don't even know that it's over, but 5 and 6 years, a community that fought over a mascot.
Right.
And it tore the town apart. I saw fistfights in the grocery store over this.
Mm.
Literal fistfights. And it brought out the worst in everybody. And I don't know, the matter has been sort of solved, but not to everyone's liking. And there's a lot of hurt feelings in between. And it's at some point, how do we diffuse that? And how do we make that something that we can talk about and work on, God forbid, a compromise, but at the very least, educate one side over the other in not an elitist fashion, which I think is exactly what happened, but instead a practical solution for the communities.
And I don't mean to say, because we're talking, well, I am. I said that we're elitists. We come across as elitists, and that turns people off when you start.
We know better.
Well, we know better, right? We know what's good for you.
If only
you don't know what's good for you,
Joe. This is woke. We can't have. This is not the way we treat Native Americans. This is not the way we do this.
Native Americans don't want this,
and so you shouldn't do this. And how dare you for thinking that it should? Even though
scolding people.
This has been your mascot for 50 years, and you played on that football team with
proudly mascot
emblazoned on your chest.
Right. Proudly played. It's so difficult. I don't know how you can carry on a conversation, not you, but we can carry on a conversation with someone who doesn't see it our way without, it almost instantly turns into scolding to them. That's what they hear. It's not what you're saying. It's what they hear. And maybe not saying anything for a little while and letting them speak will bring them into the conversation before, and it might make it more civil. I mean, I don't have an answer. I'm just saying that's the real problem. Once we, not you, Jim Hendler, I don't mean you, but once somebody maybe who is an anti-Trump person opens their mouth, they immediately sound like the same old rhetoric I've heard all along, and I don't buy it. I'm not going to have anything to do with you. I mean,
road rage incidents in this country have skyrocketed over the last 8 years. We've become entitled on both sides.
Yes.
The road is ours. It's not yours. It's not mine. We're not sharing it. I want to get to work. Get out of my way. And I'm going to honk, and I'm going to go off to the right or the left of you because I have to be where I have to be. So you can go to hell. That's what we have to address. And that's on both sides. And we, the anger that we have and the entitlement that we have to have things our way, I think, is very dangerous.
And I agree with you, Joe. I think that, and I've said it on the show for years, I think the death of empathy has been really what's behind a lot of this stuff.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, I think modern politics on both sides, but especially on one side, you can pick which one, seems to have moved to a policy of entitlement, a policy of hatred, a policy not of trying to better everybody, but of being in it for myself.
Well,
and again, when we've studied the dark web, when we've studied the places.
Unfortunately, I have to cut you off at dark web. That's unfortunate. But we may or may not pick it up on the other side of the break, but we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with our group this morning. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. My God, my God. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 12th of November. I'm Joe Donahue, Mike Spain, J.P. Miller, and Jim Hendler in the studio with me this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. And let's move on to some other topics, and then I'll go back to letters as we fill out our time together, as we have about 15 minutes or so. Two things I would like to talk about. One is the big issue of the control of the United States House of Representatives. Why California is still counting ballots. California counts methodically as House control hangs in the balance. Nine of the 16 races that will determine which party controls the House of Representatives are in California. No state takes longer to tally votes than that of California. The nation is again waiting for them to finish tallying almost 1 week after Election Day. While many states tallied the bulk of their ballots within hours of polls closing on Tuesday, California still had nearly 5 million to count going into the holiday weekend, just under a third of all the ballots that were cast there. Leaders in California, the nation's most populous state, defend the deliberate process as necessary to ensure that the tallies are accurate and that as many voters participate as possible. They say their generous provisions for voters give the public greater confidence. The delay in results has left Americans wondering why the balance of power in the House is yet to be known. It has only opened avenues for disinformation, with Democrats and Republicans seizing upon the incomplete results as evidence of voter fraud and/or manipulation. Counting votes in California is not as simple as running ballots through a machine. The state is one of a handful nationwide where every registered active voter is mailed a ballot. Mail-in ballots take longer to process than those cast in person. Election offices must verify that the signature on each envelope matches the voter's signature on file. Instead of throwing out ballots that were filled out improperly, election workers in California spend days calling voters and giving them another chance to verify their signatures so that their votes can be counted.
I'd love to hear one of those conversations. Hi, I'm calling from the election board, and I'm not sure your signature is exactly as it should be. I was wondering if you'd like to come in and correct that.
Mr. Hendler, who did you want to vote for state Supreme Court? Can you clarify on the record for us?
By the way,
I believe that their system is a little more careful than that.
By the way, I will just say that this is extremely anecdotal, but when I went and originally signed up to vote, registered to vote years and years and years ago, and when the new system went into place, and you sign your signature, right? You sign your signature. And then when you go in, you do your signature, and then the signatures match. When I first went in, there was like a fine pen that you put in, and my signature looked good. And then they gave me this thing that had the tip on it the size of an eraser that stuck to the thing like an eraser. And I didn't recognize it as mine. I don't know. Beats me. Like, they took it, but, well, I mean, they also knew who I was. But still, you know, that's an issue. But anyway, the process, known as ballot curing, occurs in half the states.
But can you imagine if somehow the presidential race came down to California? We wouldn't know for weeks.
Well, but
it'd be 2000 all over again. What a nightmare.
Yeah, although let me, you know,
I would say that the Democrat would probably win, Mike.
Well, no. I mean, let's say that the polls were that it was close.
I would still say the Democrat would probably win.
Right. But let me defend this, right? Which are we looking for, accuracy or speed? Because you can't have both.
Yes.
Right. We saw that in Florida, in Bush Gore. We've seen that in a lot of other places where, you know, the answer is, if you actually look at the margins by which some of these elections have been won, they get down to very small numbers, especially at the local level, like we were just talking about. And, you know, California had some of the weirdest voting rules in the country that also turn out to be some of the fairest. and get out a large number of voters compared to a lot of others.
So I don't disagree with you there, but again, this goes back to our problem, which is then because you don't have the results, you immediately think it's fraudulent. You immediately think that there is...
That's a new thing.
Yes.
That's a very new thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's true.
But that's
exactly
what's happening
right
here. That's what's happening right now.
Yeah.
And both Republicans and Democrats are questioning results because it is taking so long to figure out those nine races.
Right. Yeah, that term ballot curing sounds a little bit weird to me. Like we're going to cure the ballots.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It is a term.
I mean, in Pennsylvania, it's a term.
But 50% of the states.
Well, it's like curing a disease or curing ham.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on how you look at it.
I think of the ham more, yeah.
Yeah, right. So California gives counties 30 days to finalize their tallies, far longer than most states do. That means that counties can count at whatever speed suits them, hiring various levels of reinforcements and drawing up different work schedules as long as they finish by the deadline. That, according to the Secretary of State, Shirley Weber, the top election official in the state of California, Commonwealth, I believe. Ms. Weber said in an interview that she thought Californians were accustomed to a slower vote count, that other Americans became impatient only when there were national stakes, as is the case now in the House.
Yes.
That's not our problem, she said. We go as fast as we can. I think she's right on that, right?
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, currently, I mean, as of a few minutes ago, Democrats have had 205 seats go for them in the House. You need 218 to have a majority. And Republicans have 213, and there's, what, about a dozen left or something like that?
Right. I mean, do we know where they lead, of who leads?
Yeah, I don't have all that.
Several of the national organizations have called it for the Republicans.
Right.
But
projecting
not,
towards for
right,
Republicans.
Right, but they haven't projected the individual seats. So
right. Just the odds are.
That's why
the odds are.
And
that's affected, as Joe, you were saying earlier, that's affected by sitting members of Congress being appointed by Trump to various positions in his administration, like Elise Stefanik. If she ends up being approved quickly and leaves the House, a very close House majority for Republicans could be compromised, you know, and you know, then people get sick and different things happen. Other people resign. This is what happened.
A lot of old people in the Congress, 80 and 90-year-olds.
Yeah, a lot of the
don't show
the,
up for a couple of weeks.
Right.
That's how it is.
It's going to be very, very difficult for the majority, whichever the majority leader is, to wrangle votes.
You're also going to have, you know, these periods where two or three. So how long will it take to hold that special election? When will it be done?
It's the governor's call.
I know.
Yeah.
But it also can't be done instantly. I mean, you know,
well,
we do have rules and that. But I'm saying, so there will be a period where that seat is empty. And that's also, even in the states where governors make the appointments, it's usually a week or two because they have to be. The governor doesn't just sign something and say, it's this person. It's the governor brings it to the legislature that has to approve it and in some states, you know, so I mean.
Well, they don't appoint Congress seats in any states. It's senators that get appointed by governors. But Congress seats, governors set special elections.
I thought there were somewhere they could do it, but maybe I'm wrong. Okay.
Well, the point, I mean, in New York, for example, if
Elise
Stefanik gets approved and she goes off to the United Nations, it might be politically wise, from a Democratic perspective, for Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, to wait a really long time, like next fall or something, for the election to replace her, and that seat would go empty, which means it would be one less Republican for several months. You get that replicated two or three times across the country, and suddenly, you know, Michael Johnson doesn't have enough votes to do anything.
Well, technically, I imagine that Elise will be seated until she's confirmed, right?
That's correct.
And you would imagine that other members of Congress would, but you are right that the governor the governor has some discretion as to when she calls a special election, but within statute,
there is a statute.
There are guardrails as to it must be within X number of days.
Yeah.
All right. We got this letter from Jocelyn. Hello, panel. There is nothing respectable or normal about Trump's election. Neither will there be anything respectable or normal about his administration. I wish political pundits and panels and news media would stop trying to normalize what is happening in this country and normalize the cruelty and hatred that motivates Donald Trump and his loyalists. And the push to be kinder, gentler, more understanding of Trump's quote-unquote side is the biggest gaslight I have seen, smelled, or heard of in my lifetime. Don't call them names. Try to understand. Hold up on that. Trump and his loyal...
Can I just respond?
Yes, there's two more paragraphs, but
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead and finish.
Okay. Trump and his loyalists have used the most vile language and tactics to attack even the most normal and kind and accomplished among us. Where is the outrage about that? Well, it just became the norm. But now, if I say someone has to be a special kind of stupid to support Trump, I should soften my language, tamp down my tone, still my outrage. Nothing doing. And about AI, Trump and loyalists know that AI is one of the most powerful tools out there to create, repeat, and spread falsehoods and misinformation, and that most Americans are, quote, too busy or, quote, too slow to catch it and realize they are being duped. It is a large reason for his reelection. Trump is counting on an increasingly ignorant America, and he fully intends to leverage the tools to take that ignorance to deeper levels. That is how dictators get and maintain power, make the public stupid, make them hate another group, make them fearful. If you can do that, you can get the public to do anything. Trump is already part way there. So that is a letter on gaslight and normalizing. It's also an example of a letter that is too long. But
it was very good.
But a very good letter.
Yeah.
And a very thoughtful letter.
It's hard to react to something like that because I think we have like 8 seconds left. But
2 minutes. But go ahead.
You know, it's now looking as if, depending on what happens in California, we'll know maybe in a month, that the popular vote will have gone for Donald Trump. And you know, the American voters have normalized Donald Trump. I'm not saying that what Donald Trump was and is normal. I mean, we're in a totally new world here. But, you know, the very end of that nice letter, which I think was extremely articulate and made some very excellent points, is that, no, you're not really supposed to insult the people who voted for Trump. I think it's really important to listen why the majority of Americans probably now, it appears, voted for Trump,
so,
and understand that.
If
go ahead.
A quickie, but, you know, this is the conversation in my house a lot these days. I'm an institutionalist, right? I actually believe that American democracy does have checks and balances in it and will keep the absolute worst from happening. My wife disagrees and would do much more with that thing. And
things are highly likely to
swing back in
2 years, right?
It's very hard to tell where we are.
Well, also, I do think that we have to, you know, we can do both. We can try to understand and still have our principles and what we believe in.
Absolutely. Oh, I'm never suggesting otherwise. I don't mean that.
No, yeah, I didn't mean to you. Yeah. I just mean overall on this. I don't think we have to call names. But I certainly think we can have our convictions and our feelings and be mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. All right, we're out of time now. Mike's right. We can't solve democracy in 30 seconds. Damn it. We'll hold there. My thanks to our wonderful panel this morning: Jim Hendler, J.P. Miller, Mike Spain. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to everyone who listened and wrote in this morning as well. We'll be continuing the program after this short break.